it's Diane. On my mind, preparations for Black Americans. In September, Evanston, Illinois, launched a program to compensate those harmed by the city's past discriminatory housing practices. It's the first attempt at reparations for Black Americans by any governing body in the United States, but it likely won't be the last. In June, mayors from 11 cities across the country pledged to develop pilot programs that would attempt to right the wrongs committed by their respective cities. The same month, California became the first state to set up a reparations task force. Today, I talked to Mayor Daniel Biz of Evanston to hear what reparations look like on a local level. Then, to reparations experts who argue federal action is what is truly needed. Mayor Biz, please tell me about the reparations program in Evanston. How does it work?
Well, here's the basic idea, and I want to be clear about one thing. In Evanston, we have very strong feelings about the original sin of this nation regarding slavery and the role that our federal government played in that, but we don't see it as within our capability to repair that harm. And so our local reparations program is about the need, I would argue, the moral responsibility to repair harm that we as a city government caused. And so a serious amount of research was done unearthing the fact that between the years 1919 and 1969, the city government itself, in collaboration with the federal government as regards redlining and in collaboration with realtor groups and financial institutions and racist homeowners associations with their restrictive covenants and so forth, the city government itself facilitated and enforced segregation. And of course, that segregation, among many other negative consequences, had a devastated consequence regarding African-American Evanstonians' ability to build wealth and pass that wealth down from generation to generation. And so it is that harm that this program seeks to repair. And so what it does is the following. First of all, as the city government was discussing this, the state legalized the recreational use of cannabis, which provides a new revenue stream because, of course, cities can tax the sale of cannabis. And so the first thing that was done was a commitment was made that the first $10 million that are coming into the city's coffers as a consequence of cannabis tax will go into the reparations fund. So it's a $10 million promise. Now, what's been committed so far of those $10 million is just the first tiny slice, $400,000, which will go to a restorative housing program that is specifically targeted to help either individuals who themselves were victims of that discrimination, meaning they lived here prior to 1969, or their descendants, whose family wealth has been impaired by those decisions. It's a program to help individuals in those situations either purchase a home or rehab a home that they own. And the idea here basically is, listen, the harm was done through our housing policies, and so the repair should be begun in work to help support wealth building through housing.
So I understand this program began in September. Is that correct?
Applications opened in September. And so the application period goes from the end of September until early November. There's already been far more applicants than there are slots for the initial tranche of the program. So there will have to be a lottery, and then grants will be given out by the end of the year, we hope.
Why do you think the money from cannabis taxation is so small? Did you count on more than that coming in?
Well, we'd hoped that more would come in. That's right. And of course, you know, there's no time limit. And so, of course, over time, those $10 million that we've promised will come in. But it's coming in more slowly than we had anticipated. You know, I don't know how it's working in other states, but in Illinois, at least, the mechanism by which licenses are handed out and site location decisions are made has been kind of confusing, frankly. And by essentially coincidence, there's less of this commercial activity happening in the town of Evanston than in some of our neighbors. And so that's slowed down revenue, which is, of course, a shame from the point of view of getting this program up and running as quickly as we would like.
What about conditions for eligibility? How have you outlined those?
Well, for this initial program, they're quite narrow. So for this first $400,000 of reparations, there's kind of a three-tiered process. The first tier are those who we call ancestors who were themselves residents of Evanston during that period, 1919 through 1969, and are today living in Evanston. And if there are more applicants in that category than there are slots, then that will be the entirety of the of this first tranche of the program, which frankly is my guess of what's going to happen. In the event that there aren't, the next category are what we call descendants. So those are Evanston residents who are direct descendants of African-Americans who lived in Evanston between 1919 and 1969. And if it were the case that there were still room after all of the individuals in that category received grants, then there would be a third category of people who could concretely prove that they were themselves harmed by discriminatory acts perpetrated by the city of Evanston in some other manner. But again, I would be very surprised if we got to that stage simply because of the number of applications that have already come in. But, and this is a critical but, this refers to the initial kind of, you might almost call it a pilot of the first $400,000. That leaves $9.6 million that will be allocated in ways yet to be decided by our reparations committee. And the expectation is that it will not always be so narrow. The expectation is that other African Americans who don't fall into those relatively specific categories will also be eligible for the subsequent aspects of the program.
So how many have already applied?
When I last checked in, there had been something like 70 applications for 16 slots. So it was clear, you know, when we say 16 slots in a, you know, in a town with thousands and thousands of African-American residents, it was clear that this was just a very beginning. And it was clear that it wouldn't be nearly anywhere close to meeting the need and the demand. But we also felt, and I think this is really critical, that in a world where the country has been talking around this issue for decades and decades, it was critical to make a tangible step. Even if it's a small step, it really opens the door to begin doing more.
And what is the maximum you see going to each individual?
$25,000.
And is that in cash or how is that delivered?
It's delivered essentially as a part of a down payment on a home. So presuming the down payment is in excess of $25,000, the homeowner would provide, let's say it's a $40,000 down payment, the homeowner would provide $15,000 and the city would provide $25,000 and that would cover the down payment.
And who is it who determines whether an individual meets these three criteria?
So we have a reparations committee, which has three members of the city council, the members who represent wards that have the largest affected community, and then four people appointed by me. And that seven-person committee is really overseeing the work, but it's ultimately done by the city government in-house.
So why housing grants as opposed to direct cash layout?
It's a very good question, and to be candid, Diane, it's a controversial question here in Evanston. The idea behind housing was that, listen, we are trying to repair harm that was done by the city in the area of housing specifically, and so we ought to utilize the field of housing as a tool to repair that harm. Now, the other side of the argument says, listen, if you want to truly repair harm, don't attach strings. Make a cash payment and allow the person who was harmed to determine what they need and want to do with the cash. And I think that's a powerful argument as well. And in fact, when we saw the debate in town around the passage of the initial program, you know, when I tell folks in other communities that we passed reparations and it was controversial, they say, oh yeah, you must have had a lot of opponents who don't believe in reparations. And I say, no, we had none of those. We had the proponents of this program, and then we had people who believe in reparations but actually think this program either didn't go far enough or wasn't designed the way they would prefer to see. And when we appointed members of the reparations committee, it was critical to me that those appointees include folks who were dissatisfied with the initial program so that that voice will be at the table when the subsequent tranches are allocated. And I think there will be a lot of people in our community specifically saying, look, the right way to do this is not to attach strings, but rather to make direct cash payments.
Boy, that is going to be hard on those three people. Not only to determine who gets it, but they're going to get so much criticism from the community at large.
Well, it's very difficult. That's absolutely right. And I'm endlessly grateful for those who have stepped up and willing to serve in this role. But I will say that as controversial and emotionally complex as this issue is, I think still people in this community take a great deal of pride in the leadership role that we're playing and going first and standing up a program that we are being diligent and careful and methodical about setting up properly so that it can be an inspiration to communities across the country. And I think that that pride and satisfaction that folks here take in the work is also something that means a great deal to them. So I don't diminish the level of pressure and controversy at all, but I also know that people are really proud to be participating in this effort.
What about the argument that this approach is unconstitutional?
Well, that's another explanation for why the initial program is in the housing area. That the idea is, listen, we, the city government, did a specific, harmful, unjust, in retrospect, illegal thing. And so we owe restitution for our specific acts. Now, I have no doubt whatsoever that we will be sued. Of course, no lawsuits have come yet because no checks have gone out yet, so no one has standing yet. But we were threatened with lawsuits before this program was passed, and I have no doubt that that threat will be fulfilled. And I would say that I have been very impressed both with our internal team's careful, methodical efforts to design a program that they believe will withstand legal challenge, but also I'm grateful that entities from across the country, both from legal academia and from the private sector, have offered to participate with pro bono legal defense. And you know, we imagine this will be a case that'll be watched closely, and we'll have to be very, very vigorous in our defense.
What about other mayors, for example, Quentin Lucas of Kansas City, who have joined with 11 other mayors to try to create a larger program? How come it's important to you to go on your own as opposed to joining with that group?
Oh, I don't think it is. We were well along on this process and, you know, felt that turning back at that point wouldn't make sense. But I think collaboration with other municipalities, both for the purpose of sharing ideas and frankly for the purpose of sharing resources, makes an awful lot of sense. And I would encourage that. And that's the kind of thing that I like to participate in. And that reminds me, I should say something very important here. I've been the mayor of Evanston since May 10th of this year. This program has been in the works for much longer than that. And so I'm appreciative of the opportunity to speak with you about what we're doing and how proud I am of our community's efforts here. But really, the credit all lies elsewhere. The city council that was in office prior to May 10th really spearheaded this. We had a city council member by the name of Robin Rue Simmons, who was leading the way forward. This has been in motion for a long time, and it's been a lot of work by a lot of people to get us to this moment.
What about the idea of a national reparations program as opposed to a local effort?
Well, I believe that a national reparations program is morally necessary if you look at the crime of slavery that is so foundational to this country's early history. I don't think this replaces that at all. On the contrary, I think this step creates the momentum that will ultimately make it easier for the federal government to move. We see this kind of trajectory all the time, where something that is initially viewed as really out there is taken up by a single municipality, and then they enact it, and goodness, the sky does not fall. And the sun comes up in the morning, but a little bit more justice exists in that community, and it gives others the courage to do the same, and eventually that can spread to the federal government.
I wonder if you think that activity at the local level is more forward-looking than what's happening in Congress. Congress seems to be stuck in so many ways, and perhaps it's exactly as you say, that things start small and then grow in public consciousness.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that municipal government has many, many advantages in this area. The ability to move nimbly and quickly, often fewer veto points. We don't have bicameralism. I don't have a House and a Senate. I just have 9 city council members and me. In general, it's a kind of governmental system that I think is more nimble. On the other hand, let us never forget that we need the federal government to be able to act. And on most of these issues that you're alluding to, local action cannot replace federal action. It hopefully can spur federal action. So reparations is one good example. We in the city of Evanston are proud of what we're doing, but we're not going to be able, as a municipality, to repair the harm done by slavery. We need the federal government eventually to step up and do that work. Another great example, of course, is climate action, where we have a climate action resilience plan here in the city of Evanston that we are proud of, and we are prepared to make tough choices and accept difficult trade-offs to do our part in the work on climate change. But my goodness, without the federal government's bold action, we're just simply not going to be able to do what our society needs.
What about the governor of your state? On your side or not?
I have not talked directly with Governor Pritzker about this issue, but he is a progressive person with a deep, deep interest in racial justice, one who has made racial justice a focus of his time as governor, and one who understands, by the way, that racial justice isn't a silo, but it's a topic that needs to be integrated in every discussion, whether we're talking about criminal justice or climate or cannabis or what have you. And so I would expect that he would be enthusiastic about this effort. And I do know that public officials at a variety of different levels of government are watching what we do in Evanston to see how it goes. And we feel the weight of that responsibility because when you go first, you have a special obligation to do it right, to help give others the confidence that they can go next.
Have any of those who are watching contacted you?
Yeah, I mean, I had a conversation as soon as I was elected with our senior senator, Dick Durbin, who had a lot of detailed questions about a reparations program, for instance. It's something that is historically, it's been kind of a way out in left field issue in Congress, and yet now that's changing. And I think our congressional delegation understands that this is an issue they're likely to be grappling with perhaps sooner than they expected. And so I know they're watching and asking a lot of questions and trying to prepare themselves for such time as this issue might really become on the front burner in Congress.
Is there anything else you'd like to say before we close out?
Well, I feel like you've been very thorough in your questions, but I would just say that for those who are interested either in sharing ideas or resources or asking questions about how you and your own communities can start this program up or something like it, I'm always eager to talk and partner and would ask anybody to reach out and would look forward to any collaborations that could arise.
Thank you, Mayor Biz, for being with us.
Thank you, Diane. I enjoyed the conversation.
That was Mayor Daniel Biz of Evanston, Illinois. Now a quick break. When we come back, my conversation with the co-authors of the book titled From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. I'm joined by William Darity, Jr., Professor of Public Policy, African American Studies, and Economics at Duke University, and writer and folklorist Kirsten Mullen. Together, they wrote From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. William, I'd be interested on your ideas about local efforts at reparations. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think we start with the view that it would be better if they were not referred to as reparations, that is, initiatives that are taken at the local level to try to address conditions of inequity that are race-based. We actually have suggested that these initiatives be referred to as racial equity projects instead of reparations. We think that there's a confusion when people refer to these types of initiatives as reparations, in part because our focus from the standpoint of a comprehensive reparations program is eliminating racial wealth differences in the United States. And those amount to approximately $840,000 per Black and white household. And as a consequence, it would require an expenditure of at least $11 trillion to eliminate that disparity. And the total budgets of state and local governments are less than $3.5 trillion. So they simply don't have the capacity to meet the objective of eliminating the racial wealth gap.
So, Kirsten, starting slowly, for example, with cities like Evanston, Illinois, that has proposed a fund of housing grants, you would say that is not enough, or that won't work, or that would even break the city.
So the Evanston plan was, I think, Resolution 58R19, a commitment to end structural racism and achieve racial equity. The resolution is aimed at rectifying, racist practice and practice in housing that the city engaged in between 1919 and 1969. So any Black residents who were discriminated against by the city in the housing market during that 50-year period would be eligible for these funds. Now, what's complicated is, if you moved from Evanston, could you apply and use those funds, for the house that you own in some other city or state? And the answer is no. If you are not a homeowner at the moment and don't have a desire to become a homeowner, is there any way that you could apply those funds to some other expense that you had? And the answer is no. Yeah. Now, it is possible for an eligible recipient who lives in Evanston who does not want to use or cannot use the funds, they can pass those funds on to an immediate relative. But that's the only kind of transfer. But the funds are not given to the recipients, they're given to the banks. And, and for our purposes, reparations would require that any payments be made directly to the eligible recipients and not to some third party.
So in the end, William, you've said that these efforts, I think there are something like 11 mayors who've joined together to try to create a program that would meet the interests of those deserving individuals. And as you suggest, there are many, many of them. You say that these efforts are, quote, parading as reparations. What would real racial equity projects look like to you?
I think these are real racial equity projects, but they are not projects that would eliminate the racial wealth gap, which is what is central to our idea about what a reparations plan should look like. In fact, there are four major components that we advance as essential to a reparations program. The first of these is establishing who is eligible And eligibility for us is contingent on two criteria. The first criterion is an individual would have to establish an identity standard. That means that they would have to demonstrate that for at least 12 years before the onset of a reparations program, the adoption of a reparations program, or the adoption of a study commission for reparations, they self-identified as Black, Negro, African-American, or Afro-American. But they also would have to meet a lineage standard, which would involve their demonstration that they had at least one relative who was enslaved in the United States, at least one ancestor. The second characteristic of the plan must be a commitment to eliminate the racial wealth gap, which, as you know, we've said, really only the federal government has the capacity to amass the funds that would do that. The third characteristic is the project should involve direct payments to eligible recipients, just as reparations programs in the past for victimized communities have involved direct payments to the eligible recipients. So I would include here the German government's payments of funds to the individuals who were victims of the Holocaust, the United States government's payments of funds to Japanese Americans who were unjustly subjected to mass incarceration during World War II, but also other instances in which the United States government has provided reparative payments. One instance that we should add to the list is the payment of funds to the families that lost loved ones during the course of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and also payments that have been made to individuals who were held hostage in Iran towards the waning days of the Carter administration. And, you know, it's interesting to note that they have been paid, what, $10,000 a day? Yeah, for
it's about $4.3 million
per individual. And so, you know, we think that there's no reason to do it any differently in this case. And then finally, the fourth characteristic of an effective reparations plan would be that the federal government would have full priority and responsibility for funding the program.
However, wouldn't such a program truly break the bank?
When you look at the federal bailout first of banking institutions that took place in the previous decade, but also looking at you know, what's happened since the pandemic was underway with the Rescue Plan, CARES Act, you know, the federal government has paid out huge sums in record time without raising taxes. And so just as we have done so in at least five instances over the last 8 years, we could do so again. The question is, do we have the will to do it? We have the capacity to do it.
Yeah, I would add, you know, I think people tend to confuse increasing the deficit with increasing the debt. And there is actually no problem with increasing the deficit. Increasing the debt is a matter of choice on the part of the federal government. Now, one qualifier here. You can't increase the debt indefinitely without potentially triggering significant inflation.
Yes.
And any new expenditure program in the United States has to take into account the prospects of the risk of inflation. In our book, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, in the final chapter, we sketch an extended plan for reparations. And in that same chapter, we also address ways in which a reparations plan could be funded by the federal government to minimize the inflation risk.
Would you see it done gradually over a period of many years?
Well, we would hope that that this would take place over no more than 10 years. And we'd love to see it happen in a shorter period of time, but 10 on the outset.
And you would have to establish a commission or some body to meet the requirements that you've already mentioned, including eligibility, including establishing identity standards, and everything else you've talked about, how would you see such a commission being established?
Well, I mean, there would have to be a federal agency that would be responsible for administering the program. That federal agency could borrow, hopefully in a positive way, rather than in the way in which it was actually executed, but it could borrow from the principles of the old Freedmen's Bureau. And in fact, in our final chapter, we actually refer to it as the National Reparations Bureau. So it would be responsible for establishing eligibility and ensuring that the payments are administered properly. For young children, in fact, those who are below the age of majority, their eligibility would be dictated by their parents' eligibility, and they would receive the same amount of funds, but it would have to be held in a trust for them until they reached young adulthood. And so that's another management issue that would have to be handled by such an agency. But we also think that there needs to be ultimately a monitoring body or commission to supervise the agency and to review its practices. And we say in the book that this is a group that should be elected by the eligible recipients.
I see. So you would have a special election for Black Americans to choose those who would both create this council or committee and the members thereon?
Yes.
Yes, as a supervisory body, yeah.
When we talk about reparations, you hear so many white people say, well, my parents never owned slaves. My parents or I have never done anything to move against Black Americans in any way. Why should I pay taxes to make reparations?
Well, I think one of the things we would say to such individuals is, to the question, that my family didn't enslave Black people, are you sure? Have you done that research? Because in fact, the number of white households that enslaved at least one Black body is over 20%. And when you look at, and this is looking at least 20%, right?
In the southern states.
So this is not even counting the northern states. But when you look at the southern states in particular, the numbers go up dramatically. Mississippi and South Carolina, you're looking at 55 and 57% of all white households that enslaved at least one Black person. You have to go all the way up to households that owned 200 Black bodies to reach that 1%. So slavery was incredibly widespread. And then the number of white individuals who benefited from slavery, who either were employed by slavers, who were engaged in policing Black bodies, whose family provided clothing or shoes or barrels or made shackles. There are all kinds of ways that Americans were tied to the slave trade and slavery. It's not just through direct ownership of one family and human chattel. And slavery was a global economy. I mean, you had for the first time a textile industry in Connecticut and New Hampshire as a consequence of the availability of cotton. Those industries didn't exist before before slavery was in place. And the numbers are staggering. You had hundreds of these textile mills that were built. And their employees were largely white Americans. But not just cotton. The cotton exchange was made possible because of slave-grown cotton. Wall Street itself grew out of the slave trade. So this notion that there are any white families that were in the country during that period that were not tied to the slave trade is fallacious. It's just not true.
But there's another dimension of this, which is the fact that there's a set of national policies that were pursued that led to white wealth accumulation and deprived Black Americans of wealth accumulation. And we can start with the failure to provide the formerly enslaved with the 40-acre land grants that they were promised as restitution for their
years. Never received.
Yeah, never. Right. Never received. But at the same time, the federal government had instituted the Homestead Act of 1862, which provided 1.5 million white families with 160-acre land grants in the Western territories as the nation completed its colonial settler project. And so we would argue that that's the beginning of the racial wealth gap in the aftermath of the years of slavery. But there are other policies that reinforce this kind of wealth disparity across generations. And this would include the federal government's failure to intervene in the midst of upwards of 100 massacres that took place on the part of white terrorists between the end of the Civil War and the beginning of World War II, where not only were Black lives taken, but also Black property was seized and appropriated by the mobsters and became their own property. So it was a mechanism of wealth accumulation on their part. And then in the 20th century, the federal government shifts its emphasis on asset building from land acquisition to home ownership. And the home ownership process was highly discriminatory. It includes the phenomenon of redlining that Kirsten was talking about that has been the foundation for the plan that Evanston introduced. Interestingly enough, redlining was a national condition and a product of national policy. So it wasn't something that was localized in any particular city like Evanston. And it was a public-private partnership between the Federal Housing Administration and local banks.
Let me ask you both, since the federal government does not seem to be moving forward terribly aggressively or even at all on the issue of social and racial equity, doesn't the local effort make some sense? Doesn't it perhaps get things moving, even if it's local?
There certainly is a role that local governments can play, and that would be in this sphere of racial equity initiatives. And that's how we would classify the Evanston program. It's a housing voucher program. There are a number of other cities that have proposed similar initiatives, but we're just saying, let's call them what they are. We feel somewhat proprietary about the term reparations and want that to be reserved for programs that are designed to eliminate this racial wealth gap, which Sandy has said is $11 trillion on the low end. But yes, there are all kinds of initiatives that cities and states can engage in, basically doing what they should have done in the first place. Attempts to reverse the discrimination that they've engaged in for, in many cases, over a century. We used to live in Austin, Texas, and we learned that in 1928, the city council decided that it would move, either encourage or forcibly remove all of its Black residents to the east side of town. Now, as it happened, we lived on the east side, but we didn't know that there had been a law in place that forced Black people to live on the east side. Now, interestingly, that quadrant of the city, which is actually now not that distant from the downtown, and the real estate prices have gone up really high. And so now those Black residents who were forced to live there are now being pushed out because they can't afford to live there. Yeah. So there are no protections for them in any event. But this is kind of how these things have operated. So yes, there's definitely work that cities and states can do, both to correct the wrongs of the past and hopefully to garner some goodwill. But none of these initiatives are going to alter the racial wealth gap. And that's really important.
And, we would add that, although there's long been reasons to be pessimistic about federal action. I mean, there's a debt that's owed that hasn't been paid for 156 years. We think that the climate in the United States for taking reparations seriously at the federal level really has changed. If you go back to the year 2000, the beginning of this century, a study that was done by Ravana Popoff and Michael Dawson at the University of Chicago found that 4% of white Americans endorsed the making of payments to Black Americans as reparations. By the year 2018, that percentage still was relatively low, but it was dramatically higher than 4%. It was at 16%. And then today, the most recent surveys that we've seen indicate that that percentage is closer to 30. So, we don't know if this is a sustainable trend, but it certainly is a positive trend. And it would suggest that there is the prospect of making a successful case for federal action. Now, of course, it's not going to happen with the current Congress. But that's the struggle, which is to change who is in Congress.
So from your perspective, since the government's action, the federal government's action looks pretty dim right now, would you be encouraging of those local efforts to perhaps push from the bottom up so that those local representatives, senators, representatives who may eventually make it to Washington, would you encourage them to continue with their efforts?
Well, we would absolutely, be pleased to see the local governments saying, this is what we're doing in our town or our state. And we also affirm the need for a national program of reparations for Black American descendants of U.S. slavery. Durham, North Carolina, where we live, the city council led by Mayor Steve Shule passed a resolution doing just that, saying, these are some of the things that we're trying to do. They created a racial equity task force 2 years ago that outlined a number of areas where the city needs to focus its energy. And they also resolved to support a national program of reparations.
Yes, and they do not call the local actions reparations.
Right, they call it racial equity initiatives.
This is all very interesting. I want to thank you both so much, William and Kirsten, for being with me.
Thank you so much for having us.
That was Professor William Darity, Jr. and Kirsten Mullen, co-authors of From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody with help from Sandra Baker. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.